not insufficient cash flow, which we had been in the beginning, but excess cash flow. And there were several reasons for that. We had cash flow coming from these now very large government contracts where we didn't have capital investment. And we had the on-site plants had grown very large for the steel industry and the petroleum industry. And in the way we worked in those cases was we would get a 15-year contract, say, from a major steel company or a major oil company to supply a given amount of gas on a daily basis. And then we would take that contract, and in those days the credit of the steel industry and the oil industry too was so great that we could take that contract to insurance companies where we took it and get the capital for the building the plant. And whereas we could have accelerated, we'd have under the Internal Revenue Service, we had an 11-year depreciation on these plants, we had a new investment tax credit at certain times, and we had a double declining balance depreciation. So we were generating far more cash than it took to pay the loan to the insurance company. So what to do with this cash? Well, there was a big hassle about that at that time. Some of the outside directors said, pay the dividends to the stockholders. Others said, there was, like this enterprise here, which was started by U.S. Steel. If you recall, in that period, there were lots of big companies, U.S. Steel and Westinghouse and others, who went into real estate development business. And we thought about, we were advocates of that. I thought that we have built up a technical capability in engineering, and the thing that's closest to what we're doing in the industrial gas, hydrogen, and all those things, and we had the ammonia, we had a little toehold in the ammonia, was a further movement into the chemical industry. So we started trying to do that. And we didn't have the technology. We licensed some technology from Europe. We built a plant in Delaware City to make plastics additives, licensed from Kuhlmann in Europe. Then we acquired this company here in Florida. Scambia Chemical Company. We acquired we did it mostly by acquisition, and then took these businesses that hadn't had an adequate infusion of capital, hadn't had an adequate infusion of management and technology, and we jazzed them up somewhat, and that's a very successful part of the company now.
Well, the name was changed to Air and Products and Chemicals.
The name of the company, yeah, right.
And I'm not sure when that occurred.
Oh, it was probably 1960, maybe, something like that.
And acquired Hoodry at that time?
We thought Hoodry had been a part of Sun Oil Company and had done research and developed catalytic cracking and so forth. And Sun was accused of having a conflict of interest because they had their own research and Hoodry had some public shareholders, and so they wanted to sell it. We thought, that's wonderful. That's what we need, a research capability. So we bought it from them. It turned out that it was a misjudgment, although it was a marvelous misjudgment, in that Hoodry research had grown old and stale, and it really wasn't productive research. But they had all these licenses for various hydrocarbon products, the cracking technology and butadiene and other things. And in the Third World and in Asia and in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, they wanted those technologies. And that turned out to be a tremendous cash cow, where we licensed all those and got increased amounts of cash flow that we didn't anticipate. But that's the way it fell out. It was just a lucky situation.
There's a statement, this is some years later, because I think Ted Burtis came along with Hoodry,
mm-hmm.
didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But then he left.
Ted came, and he was the head of Hoodry, and then he was recruited by Sun to come back and become chairman of Sun Oil.
But this statement out of thin air says the following, the decline of Dabco and of Hoodry in general was one less happy consequence of the Air Products culture. That culture was inhospitable to the style of research on which Hoodry had depended for its innovations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Air Products was, well, the Hoodry people were older, for one thing, and they didn't have a commercial orientation. Mr. Hoodry had run it, and the commercial approach of Hoodry was to develop some leading edge thing, they were leading edge at the time they developed them, but then license them to others, and they were those guys, and they were in their 50s, and most of us were in our 30s. It wasn't possible. The culture was a very powerful thing. Boy, I learned that in that experience. To get those folks to change. When we had a tremendous debate shortly after we acquired Hoodry, because that's when we started this plastics additives business, the oxo alcohol that I mentioned. And here's what we did. We didn't have the technology, so we licensed it from Kuhlmann. We didn't have the feedstock, so we got we made Getty Oil a joint venture to provide the feedstock. We didn't have a market, so we entered into a contract with Reichhold Chemical Company to take the output. And it was fantastic. We took the Reichhold contract to the insurance company. We got the capital on high ratio debt, and the return on the net worth that we invested there was just fabulous. Well, the Hoodry guys, when we were putting this deal together, said, we don't want to be any part of it. That won't work. You're not contributing anything. Somebody else's technology, somebody else's market, somebody else's... Yes, we're contributing something. We're contributing the entrepreneurship. Well, that was a foreign language. And we never got together on that.
By 1973, Leonard Poole had finally turned everything over to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think he died a few years after that. But prior to that point, he sort of still considered it his company. Is that?
Oh yeah. And he turned his attention after his first wife's, Dorothy's, death. He turned his attention to the healthcare thing. And he, besides leaving Air Products, he left another precious heritage in the Lehigh Valley, and that's the healthcare system. Lehigh Valley Hospital is now the largest hospital in Pennsylvania. It's enormously successful, and he created all that so that the people in a community like that could have health care of the quality that she was able to get by going to Sloan Kettering Hospital. And during the past 10 or 15 years of his life, he still considered, well, I'm sure the day he died, he considered Air Products his baby. But he had made up his mind that he wanted the team, me and others, to run it, and that's the way he did. And he was in those latter years of his life doing for the hospital what he had done in early years for the company, and he ran that hospital business. Some of the people over there told me called in the general manager one day and pointed out to him that there were squeaking doors in some of the hospital rooms. So,
and he was that detailed at Air Products, too,
beginning, yes.
Yes. When was it in your career with Air Products that you finally realized that Leonard Poole had tapped you to be his successor?
Well, I don't know if it happened and I didn't have a blinding light strike me any one particular day. Dorothy played an important role in it, his first wife. She was an enormously gifted, dedicated woman. She helped him. She was Leonard was a very mercurial guy. He'd have ups and downs psychologically. And she was a very stable, steady influence. And she had a campaign going with him very early, actually. She wanted to retire, and he and she go away somewhere and relax a little. That would never have happened. That wasn't in his temperament. But she wanted him to have me take more responsibility over quite a long period of time. Now the third, I should mention this, the company really consists now of three parts, the industrial gas and the chemistry and the environmental systems. And we never considered that part of our business environment. And I wasn't struck by a blinding light at any one time in regard to taking more responsibility. I do think, and I thought then looking back, that on that first Earth Day, which was probably 25 years ago, I happened to be in New York City that day, and if you recall, Fifth Avenue was closed down, and there were tens of thousands, maybe 100,000, I don't know, of people, mostly young people, sitting on Fifth Avenue in the street, singing songs about the environment and so forth. And I said, this is a movement that's got enormous force in this country. And I started, that one experience did have an impact upon me. And I started talking to our research guys and looking for ways that we could license some technology in Europe and Japan, where actually, you know, they'd been more advanced than we were. We developed then some biological processes which would permit use of oxygen to develop biological species which would, for tertiary cleanup of sewage. We thought that was going to be a good business, and it would have been a good business, except because what we were going to do is make a couple of them, one right here in Largo, Florida, where we would contract with the municipality on a long-term contract to treat their sewage. But then the movement had so much force that the federal government started pumping money in, and instead of the municipalities contract with a company like us to put the capital in and perform the service, they got federal money. Mm-hmm. And the plants are run by municipalities, in most cases not very well. So that business didn't turn out to have a commercial appeal, but we did others, the solid waste to energy and the scrubbers for the stack gases, and that's a third part of the company that's really got enormous prospects now.
You made an interesting comment, because when Earth Day and the concern about the environment really became obvious to the chemical industry, some industries tried to stonewall, as with Rachel Carson. I know that Ted Dillon has told me at Dow that he went back and people were worried. He said, no, we can turn this into something positive, which is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, right.
But how did you sense your counterparts in the rest of the industry?
Yeah,
and
I
their
sensed
reaction?
Them like you say. But I was inspired by Ted Doan and by Gerstacker, mm-hmm. Because they were they were strong advocates of exactly what you said. And then I was going around in the Chemical Manufacturers Association making speeches, and I took over the chairmanship of the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to try and bring industry around. And I was making speeches those times saying, sure, it costs a buck to improve the environment, but the buck isn't spent on the moon, it's spent here with another company. And let's find out how to take advantage of that.
When you took over in 73, in the sense that Leonard Poole had finally turned things really over to you, one of the things you did was to introduce the matrix management concept, and I'm not sure whether that came out of your Harvard Business School experience or not.
No, I don't remember ever hearing about that at Harvard Business School, but... And if I were in a company today, I would abolish matrix management because you just can't do that. But it's too expensive. But in those times, we were growing so rapidly, and we had so many inexperienced people that we made mistakes, and some of them were quite costly. And so I was trying to develop a way that we could have checks and balances, and that's what we called matrix management. So we set up... It grew out of what we wanted. Leonard said, Ed Donnelly is going to be vice president and general manager. Well, what did that mean? Because we had guys like George, Carl Anderson, who was 25 years older than I, Clarence Schilling, who was one of the old stalwart people with the technical background, Frank Pavlis, old guard guys who were part of Leonard's original team. Well, I wasn't, and I was quite a lot younger than they, and I wasn't in a position to be their boss. So I began devising a structure and proposing it to Leonard and to them, where those guys would continue to report directly to Leonard, not to me. That was important to them, and it was inappropriate to ask them to report to me anyway. But then I would, if you use what's common terminology today, I'd be chief operating officer. I'd be the line officer managing the business, and they'd be staff experts giving advice to me and to the other people who reported to me in their field of technical expertise. So in order to get that staff knowledge utilized, we had to have what we called a matrix, so that the line people would run the company, but they'd get advice and consultation from the staff people.
This must have been quite a change for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was. It was very hard to get it done. And I think it was the right thing was needed at that time, because the company didn't have the company today is entirely different. It's got people who've been in their job for 10, 20 years. In those days, we had people, we grew for many years there at a compound rate of 15%. So we doubled every 5 years, and doubled again, and doubled again. And so we were having people do things that they didn't have any experience doing.
Several other things that happened at that time. You also stressed the role of engineering in long-term planning and the importance of that in decision-making. How did you... encourage decision making at a lower management level? Earlier, everybody had gone to Leonard Poole. Now that wasn't the case anymore.
Well, I wanted engineers. You see, Carl Anderson, and I have tremendous admiration for Carl Anderson. He is a person of enormous integrity, and there was There would, in an organization where Anderson was president, his moral authority was so high that there would never be any corner cutting. And that was a contribution of morality, integrity, that he brought to the corporation as it grew. That was his strength. What I guess I would maybe call it a weakness, in that Anderson never, he said it over and over, he's an engineer. Management has to tell us what to engineer, and then we'll engineer it. And I didn't think that was the right thing to do. I thought the engineer should be part of management. The other people should be part of management. The finance professionals should be part of management, and so forth. And so it was that kind of old-style authoritarian direction from the top that I thought was ought to be broken down, and that was what I was trying to do without ever being offended. I never would have said anything derogatory to or about Carl Anderson.
Another thing that you encouraged at that time was combining an MBA degree with an engineering degree.
Yeah, well, part of the same syndrome, I think, yeah. A lot of those MBA guys have done enormously well in the company. The management nowadays is really, MBAs are unfashionable today, but that whole top management group now are guys with engineering and MBA degrees.
I don't remember at that particular time whether that was unusual. Were you one of the leaders in that kind, in that movement of combining a technical degree with an MBA?
I don't think too much. I think there was a time when it was very popular. I think though that we were able to bring in, there was a lot of competition for MBAs in those days because it was so popular and fashionable. But a lot went to Wall Street, a lot went into consulting firms and got enormous salaries, and it was hard for manufacturing companies to attract them, but we had an advantage that many manufacturing companies didn't have, and that we were growing so rapidly. This company is size X now, but in 5 years it's going to be 2X, and in 10 years it's going to be 4X, and so it was enabled us to recruit not just MBAs, but the top people in all categories.
You had plenty of opportunities to offer people.
Yeah, yes. Right. And we had the image. We were perceived as being having opportunity.
You also brought back something that Leonard Poole had introduced earlier called the Career Development Program.
Yeah. Well... yeah, we did that. We always did that. And the essence of it was that we recognized always that there are some professionals in science or engineering or accounting or tax policy or whatever, some people law, some people may have a certain discipline, professional discipline that they want to follow, and that's their career objective. But for someone who's going to be a general officer of the company, chairman, president, vice president, or whatever, they will be able to do those jobs more effectively if they have diversified experience. So we used to have what we called double diamond charts. They would chart the theoretical progression of a person through his career. And if he went straight through without taking these diversified experiences on a double diamond, he wouldn't be as well equipped at age 45 or whatever to take on more responsibility. So we had we put it all eventually on computers. That if a person worked for 5 years in a given discipline with no diversified experience, that printed up on a computer program, and his supervisor had to say why that was so. It may be, and we recognize it may be very legitimate, mm-hmm. maybe the right mm-hmm. thing for that person, mm-hmm. but we don't want to let people drift into not having diversified experience. That's what that was basically all about. And it's done yet today. It sort of became embedded in the... I haven't talked to Hap or those guys about it lately, but it's kind of embedded in the culture of the company.
Just change the tape now. I know that you had...